I carried the IBM back into the house and left the manuscript on top. I was done with it, at least for the time being. No more looking for the way back through the wardrobe. No more Andy Drake and John Shackelford until this was over. And as I dressed in long pants and a button-up shirt for the first time in what felt like weeks, it occurred to me that perhaps something, some force, had been trying to sedate me with the story I was telling, with the ability to work again. It made sense. Work had always been my drug of choice, even better than the booze or the Melorel I still kept in the bathroom medicine cabinet. Or maybe the work was only the delivery system, the hypo with all the dreamy dreams inside it. Maybe the real drug was the zone, being in the zone, feeling it, you sometimes hear the basketball players say. I was in the zone, and I was really feeling it. I grabbed the keys to the Chevrolet off the counter and looked at the fridge as I did. The magnets were circled again. In the middle was a message I'd seen before, one that was now instantly understandable thanks to the extra Magnabet letters. Help her. I'm doing my best, I said, and went out. Three miles north on Route 68, by then you're on the part of it which used to be known as Castle Rock Road, there's a greenhouse with a shop in front of it. Slips and Greens, it's called, and Joe used to spend a fair amount of time there, buying gardening supplies or just noodling with the two women who ran the place. One of them was Helen Oster, Kenny's wife. I pulled in there at around 10 o'clock that Sunday morning. It was open, of course. During tourist season, almost every main shopkeeper turns heathen. And parked next to a Beamer with New York plates. I paused long enough to hear the weather forecast on the radio, continued hot and humid for another 48 hours at least, and then got out. A woman wearing a bathing suit, a skirt, and a giant red sun hat emerged from the shop with a bag of peat moss cradled in her arms. She gave me a little smile. I returned it with 18% interest. She was from New York, and that meant she wasn't a Martian. The shop was even hotter and damper than the white morning outside. Lila Prue, the co-owner, was on the phone. There was a little fan beside the cash register, and she was standing directly in front of it, flapping the front of her sleeveless blouse. She saw me and twiddled her fingers in a wave. I twiddled mine back, feeling like someone else. Work or no work, I was still zoning, still feeling it. I walked around the shop, picking up a few things almost at random, watching Lila out of the corner of my eye and waiting for her to get off the phone so I could talk to her. And all the time, my own private hyperdrive was humming softly away. At last she hung up, and I came to the counter. "Michael Noonan, what a sight for sore eyes you are," she said, and began ringing up my purchases. "I was awfully sorry to hear about Joanna. Got to get that right up front. Joe was a pet." "Thanks, Lila." "Welcome. Don't need to say any more about it, but with a thing like that, it's best to put it right up front. I've always believed it, always will believe it, right up front. Going to do a little gardening, are you?"
"If it ever cools off."
"Aya, isn't it wicked?" She flapped the top of her blouse again to show me how wicked it was, then pointed at one of my purchases. "Want this one in a special bag? Always safe, never sorry, that's my motto." I nodded, then looked at the little blackboard tilted against the counter. "Fresh blueberries," the chalked message read. "The crop is in." "I'll have a pint of berries, too," I said, "as long as they're not Fridays. I can do better than Friday." She nodded vigorously, as if to say she knew damned well I could. "These were on the bush yesterday. That fresh enough for you?"
"Good as gold," I said.
"Blueberry's the name of Kenny's dog, isn't it?" "Ain't he a funny one? God, I love a big dog if he's behaved." She turned, got a pint of berries from her little fridge, and put them in another bag for me. "Where's Helen?" I asked. "Day off?" "Not her," Lila said. "If she's in town, you can't get her out of this place unless you beat her with a stick. She and Kenny and the kids went down to Taxachusetts. Them and her brother's family club together and get a seaside cottage 2 weeks every summer. They all went. Old Blueberry, he'll chase seagulls until he drops." She laughed. It was a loud and hearty one. It made me think of Sarah Tidwell.
Or maybe it was the way Lila looked at me as she did it. There was no laughter in her eyes. They were small and considering, coldly curious. "Would you, for Christ's sake, quit it?" I told myself. "They can't all be in on it together, Mike." Couldn't they, though? There is such a thing as town consciousness. Anyone who doubts it has never been to a New England town meeting. Where there's a consciousness, is there not likely to be a subconscious? And if Kyra and I were doing the old mind-meld thing, could not other people in TR-90 also be doing it, perhaps without even knowing it? We all shared the same air and land. We shared the lake and the aquifer which lay below everything, buried water tasting of rock and minerals. We shared the street as well, that place where good pups and vile dogs could walk side by side. As I started out with my purchases in a cloth carry-handle bag, Lila said, "What a shame about Royce Merrill. Did you hear?" "No," I said. "Fell down his cellar stairs yesterday evening. What a man his age was doing going down such a steep flight of steps is beyond me, but I suppose once you get to his age, you have your own reasons for doing things." "Is he dead?" I started to ask, then rephrased. It wasn't the way the question was expressed on the TR. "Did he pass?" "Not yet. Martin Rescue took him to Castle County General. He's in a coma. They don't think he'll ever wake up, poor fella. There's a piece of history that'll die with him." "I suppose that's true." Good riddance, I thought. "Does he have children?" "No. There have been Merrills on the TR for 200 years. One died at Seminary Ridge. But all the old families are dying out now. You have a nice day, Mike." She smiled. Her eyes remained flat and considering. I got into my Chevy, put the bag with my purchases in it on the passenger seat, then simply sat for a moment, letting the air conditioner pour cool air on my face and neck. Kenny Oster was in Taxachusetts. That was good, a step in the right direction. But there was still my caretaker.
"Bill's not here," a vet said.
She stood in the door, blocking it as well as she could. You can only do so much in that regard when you're 5'3 and weigh roughly 100 pounds. Studying me with the gimlet gaze of a nightclub bouncer, denying re-entry to a drunk who's already been tossed out on his ear once. I was on the porch of the neat-as-ever-you-saw Cape Cod, which stands at the top of Peabody Hill and looks all the way across New Hampshire and into Vermont's backyard. Bill's equipment sheds were lined up to the left of the house, all of them painted the same shade of gray, each with its own sign: Dean Caretaking Number 1, Number 2, and Number 3. Parked in front of Number 2 was Bill's Dodge Ram. I looked at it, then back at Yvette. Her lips tightened a little more. Another notch, and I figured they'd be gone entirely.
"He went to North Conway with Butch Wiggins," she said. "They went in Butch's truck to get..."
"No need lying for me, dear heart," Bill said from behind her. It was still 2 hours shy of noon, and on the Lord's Day to boot, but I had never heard a man who sounded more tired. He clumped down the hall, and as he came out of its shadows and into the light, the sun was finally burning through the murk. I saw that Bill now looked his age, every year of it, and maybe 10 more to grow on. He was wearing his usual khaki shirt and pants. Bill Dean would be a Dickies man until the day he died. But his shoulders looked slumped, almost sprained, as if he'd spent a week lugging buckets that were too heavy for him. The falling away of his face had finally begun, an indefinable something that makes the eyes look too big, the jaw too prominent, the mouth a bit loose. He looked old. There were no children to carry on the family line of work, either. All the old families were dying out, Lila Prue had said, and maybe that was a good thing.
"Bill,"
she began, but he raised one of his big hands to stop her. The calloused fingertips shook a little.
"Go in the kitchen a dite," he told her. "I need to talk to my compadre here. 'Twon't take long."
Yvette looked at him, and when she looked back at me, she had indeed reached zero lip surface. There was just a black line where they had been, like a mark dashed off with a pencil. I saw with woeful clarity that she hated me.
"Don't you tire him out," she said to me. "He hasn't been sleeping. It's the heat."
She walked back down the hall, all stiff back and high shoulders, disappearing into shadows that were probably cool. It always seems to be cool in the houses of old people. Have you noticed? Bill came out onto the porch and put his big hands into the pockets of his pants without offering to shake with me.
"I ain't got nothing to say to you. You and me's quits."
"Why, Bill? Why are we quits?" He looked west where the hills stepped into the burning summer haze, disappearing into it before they could become mountains, and said nothing. "I'm trying to help that young woman." He gave me a look from the corners of his eyes that I could read well enough.
"Yeah, help yourself right into her pants. I see men come up from New York and New Jersey with their young girls. Summer weekends, ski weekends, it don't matter. Men who go with girls that age always look the same. Got their tongues run out even when their mouths are shut. Now you look the same."
I felt both angry and embarrassed, but I resisted the urge to chase him in that direction. That was what he wanted. "What happened here?" I asked him. "What did your fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers do to Sarah Tidwell and her family? You didn't just move them on, did you?"
"Didn't have to," Bill said, looking past me at the hills.
His eyes were moist almost to the point of tears, but his jaw was set and hard.
"They moved on themselves. Never was a nigger who didn't have an itchy foot, my dad used to say."
"Who set the trap that killed son Tidwell's boy? Was it your father, Bill? Was it Fred?" His eyes moved. His jaw never did.
"I don't know what you're talking about.
I hear him crying in my house. Do you know what it's like to hear a dead child crying in your house? Some bastard trapped him like a weasel, and I hear him crying in my fucking house."
"You're going to need a new caretaker," Bill said. "I can't do for you no more. Don't want to. What I want is for you to get off my porch."
"What's happening? Help me, for Christ's sake."
"I'll help you with the toe of my shoe if you don't get going on your own."
I looked at him a moment longer, taking in the wet eyes and the set jaw, his divided nature written on his face. "I lost my wife, you old bastard," I said, "a woman you claim to love." Now his jaw moved at last. He looked at me with surprise and injury.
"That didn't happen here," he said. "That didn't have anything to do with here. She might have been off the TI because, well, she might have had her reasons to be off the TI, but she just had a stroke. Would have happened anywhere. Anywhere."
"I don't believe that. I don't think you do either. Something followed her to Derry. Maybe because she was pregnant." Bill's eyes widened. I gave him a chance to say something, but he didn't take it. "Or maybe just because she knew too much."
"She had a stroke." Bill's voice wasn't quite even. "I read the obituary myself. She had a damn stroke."
"What did she find out? Talk to me, Bill. Please."
There was a long pause. Until it was over, I allowed myself the luxury of thinking I might actually be getting through to him. "I've only got one more thing to say to you, Mike. Stand back. For the sake of your immortal soul, stand back and let things run their course. They will, whether you do or don't. This river has almost come to the sea. It won't be dammed by the likes of you. Stand back, Mike, for the love of Christ."
"Do you care about your soul, Mr. Noonan? God's butterfly caught in a cocoon of flesh that will soon stink like mine?"
Bill turned and walked to his door, the heels of his work boots clodding on the painted boards. "Stay away from Maddie and Kai," I said, "if you so much as go near that trailer." He turned back, and the hazy sunshine glinted on the tracks below his eyes. He took a bandana from his back pocket and wiped his cheeks.
"I ain't stirring from this house. I wish to God I'd never come back from my vacation in the first place, but I did. Mostly on your account, Mike. Those two down on Wasp Hill have nothing to fear from me." "No, not from me."
He went inside and closed the door. I stood there looking at it, feeling unreal. Surely I could not have had such a deadly conversation with Bill Dean, could I? Bill, who had reproached me for not letting folks down here share and perhaps ease my grief for Joe. Bill, who had welcomed me back so warmly. Then I heard a clack sound. He might not have locked his door while he was at home in his entire life, but he had locked it now. The clack was very clear in the breathless July air. It told me everything I had to know about my long friendship with Bill Dean. I turned and walked back to my car, my head down. Nor did I turn when I heard a window run up behind me.
"Don't you ever come back here, you town bastard!"
a vet Dean cried across the sweltering dooryard.
"You've broken his heart! Don't you ever come back! Don't you ever! Don't you ever!"
"Please," Mrs. M. said. "Don't ask me any more questions, Mike. I can't afford to get in Bill Dean's bad books any more than my ma could afford to get into Norman Auster's or Fred Dean's." I shifted the phone to my other ear. "All I want to know is, in this part of the world, caretakers pretty well run the whole show. If they say to a summer fella that he should hire this carpenter or that electrician, why, that's who the summer fella hires. Or if the caretaker says this one should be fired because he ain't proven reliable, he is fired. Or she. Because what goes once for plumbers and landscapers and electricians has always gone twice for housekeepers. If you want to be recommended and stay recommended, you have to keep on the sunny side of people like Fred and Bill Dean or Normal and Kenny Auster. Don't you see?" She was almost pleading. "When Bill found out I told you about what Norman Auster did, ooh, he was so mad at me." Kenny Auster's brother, the one Normal drowned under the pump, his name was Kerry? "Aya, I've known a lot of folks name their kids alike, think it's cute. Why, I went to school with a brother and sister named Roland and Rolanda Terrio. I think Roland's in Manchester now, and Rolanda married that boy from..." "Brenda, just answer one question. I'll never tell. Please?" I waited, my breath held, for the click that would come when she put her telephone back in its cradle. Instead, she spoke three words in a soft, almost regretful voice. "What is it?" "Who was Carla Dean?" I waited through another long pause, my hand playing with the ribbon that had come off Kai's turn-of-the-century straw hat. "You dasn't tell anyone I told you anything," she said at last. "I won't." Carla was Bill's twin sister. She died 65 years ago during the time of the fires. The fires Bill claimed had been set by Kai's grandfather, his going-away present to the TR. I don't know just how it happened. Bill never talks about it. If you tell him I told you I'll never make another bed in the TR, he'll see to it. Then, in a hopeless voice, she said, "He may know anyway." Based on my own experiences and surmises, I guessed she might be right about that. But even if she was, she'd have a check from me every month for the rest of her working life. I had no intention of telling her that over the telephone, though. It would scald her Yankee soul. Instead, I thanked her, assured her again of my discretion, and hung up. I sat at the table for a moment, staring blankly at Bunter, then said, "Who's here?" No answer. "Come on," I said. "Don't be shy. Let's go 19 or 92 down. Barring that, let's talk." Still no answer. Not so much as a shiver of the bell around the stuffed moose's neck. I spied the scribble of notes I'd made while talking to Joe's brother and drew them toward me. I had put Kaya, Kyra, Keto, and Carla in a box. Now I scribbled out the bottom line of that box and added the name Carrie to the list. "I've known a lot of folks name their kids alike," Mrs. M. had said. "They think it's cute." I didn't think it was cute. I thought it was creepy. It occurred to me that at least two of these sound-alikes had drowned. Carrie Auster under a pump, Kaya Noonan in her mother's dying body when she wasn't much bigger than a sunflower seed. And I had seen the ghost of a third drowned child in the lake. Keto? Was that one Keto?
or was Keto the one who had died of blood poisoning? They name their kids alike. They think it's cute. How many sound-alike kids had there been to start with? How many were left? I thought the answer to the first question didn't matter, and I knew the answer to the second one already. This river has almost come to the sea, Bill had said. Carla, Carrie, Keto, Kaya, all gone. Only Kyra DeVore was left. I got up so fast and hard that I knocked over my chair. The clatter and the silence made me cry out. I was leaving, and right now. No more telephone calls, no more playing Andy Drake, private detective, no more depositions or half-assed wooings of the lady fair. I should have followed my instincts and gotten the fuck out of Dodge that first night. Well, I'd go now, just get in the Chevy and haul ass for Dare. Bunter's bell jangled furiously. I turned and saw it bouncing around his neck as if batted to and fro by a hand I couldn't see. The screen door giving on the deck began to fly open and clap shut like something hooked to a pulley. The book of tough stuff crossword puzzles on the sofa and the DSS program guide blew open, their pages riffling. There was a series of rattling thuds across the floor as if something enormous was crawling rapidly toward me, pounding its fists as it came. A draft. Not cold, but warm, like the rush of air produced by a subway train on a summer night, buffeted past me. In it, I heard a strange voice which seemed to be saying, "Bye, bye, 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 bye," as if wishing me a good trip home. Then, as it dawned on me that the voice was actually saying, "Kai, kai, 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 kai," something struck me and knocked me violently forward. It felt like a large, soft fist. I buckled over the table, clawing at it to stay up, overturning the Lazy Susan with the salt and pepper shakers on it, the napkin holder, the little vase Mrs. M. had filled with daisies. The vase rolled off the table and shattered. The kitchen TV blared on, some politician talking about how inflation was on the march again. The CD player started up, drowning out the politician. It was the Rolling Stones doing a cover of Sarah Tidwell's "I Regret You, Baby." Upstairs, one smoke alarm went off, then another, then a third. They were joined a moment later by the warble whoop of the Chevy's car alarm. The whole world was cacophony. Something hot and pillowy seized my wrist. My hand shot forward like a piston and slammed down on the steno pad. I watched as it pawed clumsily to a blank page, then seized the pencil which lay nearby. I gripped it like a dagger, and then something wrote with it, not guiding my hand, but raping it. The hand moved slowly at first, almost blindly, then picked up speed until it was flying, almost tearing through the sheet. "Help her. Don't go. Help her. Don't go. Help her. Help. Don't. Baby, please don't go. Help her. Help her. Help her." I had almost reached the bottom of the page when the cold descended again, that outer cold that was like sleet in January, chilling my skin and crackling the snot in my nose and sending two shuddery puffs of white air from my mouth. My hand clenched and the pencil snapped in two. Behind me, Bunter's bell rang out one final furious convulsion before falling silent. Also from behind me came a peculiar double pop, like the sound of champagne corks being drawn. Then it was over. Whatever it had been, or however many they had been, it was finished. I was alone again. I turned off the CD player just as Mick and Keith moved on to a white boy version of Howling Wolf, then ran upstairs and pushed the reset buttons on the smoke detectors. I leaned out the window of the big guest bedroom while I was up there, aimed the fob of my key ring down at the Chevrolet, and pushed the button on it. The alarm quit. With the worst of the noise gone, I could hear the TV cackling away in the kitchen. I went down, killed it, then froze with my hand still on the off button, looking at Joe's annoying waggy cat clock. Its tail had finally stopped switching, and its big plastic eyes lay on the floor. They had popped right out of its head. I went down to the village cafe for supper, snagging the last Sunday telegram from the rack. "Computer mogul DeVore dies in Western Maine town where he grew up," the headline read, before sitting down at the counter. The accompanying photo was a studio shot of DeVore that looked about 30 years old. He was smiling. Most people do that quite naturally. On DeVore's face, it looked like a learned skill. I ordered the beans that were left over from Buddy Jellison's Saturday night beanhole supper. My father wasn't much for aphorisms. In my family, dispensing nuggets of wisdom was Mom's job. But as Daddy warmed up the Saturday night yellow eyes in the oven on Sunday afternoon, he would invariably say that beans and beef stew was better the second day. I guess it stuck. The only other piece of fatherly wisdom I can remember receiving was that you should always wash your hands after you took a shit in a bus station. While I was reading the story on DeVore, Audrey came over and told me that Royce Merrill had passed without recovering consciousness. The funeral would be Tuesday afternoon at Grace Baptist, she said. Most of the town would be there, many folks, just to see Isla Meserve awarded the Boston Post cane. Did I think I'd get over? No, I said, probably not. I thought it prudent not to add that I'd likely be attending a victory party at Maddie DeVore's while Royce's funeral was going on down the road. The usual late Sunday afternoon flow of customers came and went while I ate. People ordering burgers, people ordering beans, people ordering chicken salad sandwiches, people buying six-packs. Some were from the TR, some from away. I didn't notice many of them, and no one spoke to me. I have no idea who left the napkin on my newspaper, but when I put down the A section and turned to find the sports, there it was. I picked it up, meaning only to put it aside, and saw what was written on the back in big dark letters. Get off the TR. I never found out who left it there. I guess it could have been any of them. The murk came back and transformed that Sunday night's dusk into a thing of decadent beauty. The sun turned red as it slid down toward the hills, and the haze picked up the glow, turning the western sky into God's nosebleed. I sat out on the deck and watched it, trying to do a crossword puzzle and not getting very far. When the phone rang, I dropped Tough Stuff on top of my manuscript as I went to answer it. I was tired of looking at the title of my book every time I passed. "Hello? What's going on up there?" John Starrow demanded. He didn't even bother to say hi. He didn't sound angry, though. He sounded totally pumped. "I'm missing the whole goddamn soap opera." "I invited myself to lunch on Tuesday," I said. "Hope you don't mind." "No, that's good. The more the merrier." He sounded as if he absolutely meant it. "What a summer, huh? What a summer! Anything happened just lately? Earthquakes? Volcanoes? Mass suicides?" "No mass suicides, but the old guy died," I said. "Shit, the whole world knows Max DeVore kicked it," he said. "Surprise me, Mike. Stun me. Make me holler, boy, howdy." "No, the other old guy, Royce Merrill. I don't know who you..." "Oh, wait. The one with the gold cane who looked like an exhibit from Jurassic Park?" "That's him." "Bummer. Otherwise?" "Otherwise, everything's under control," I said, then thought of the popped-out eyes of the cat clock and almost laughed. What stopped me was a kind of surety that Mr. Good Humor Man was just an act. John had really called to ask what, if anything, was going on between me and Maddie. And what was I going to say? Nothing yet? One kiss, one instant blue steel hard-on, the fundamental things apply as time goes by? I didn't know and didn't have to find out. John had other things on his mind. "Listen, Michael, I called because I've got something to tell you. I think you'll be both amused and amazed. A state we all crave," I said. "Lay it on me." "Roget Whitmore called and..." "You didn't happen to give her my parents' number, did you? I'm back in New York now, but she called me in Philly." "I didn't have your parents' number. You didn't leave it on either of your machines." "Oh, right." No apology. He seemed too excited to think of such mundanities. I began to feel excited myself, and I didn't even know what the hell was going on. I gave it to Maddie. "Do you think the Whitmore woman called Maddie to get it? Would Maddie give it to her?"
I'm not sure that if Maddie came upon Roguette flaming in a thoroughfare, she'd piss on her to put her out. Vulgar, Michael. Trey Vulgarino. But he was laughing. Maybe Whitmore got it the same way DeVore got yours. Probably so, I said. I don't know what'll happen in the months ahead, but right now I'm sure she's still got access to Max DeVore's personal control panel, and if anyone knows how to push the buttons on it, it's probably her. Did she call from Palm Springs? Uh-huh. She said she just finished a preliminary meeting with DeVore's attorneys concerning the old man's will. According to her, Grandpa left Maddie DeVore $80 million. I was struck silent. I wasn't amused yet, but I was certainly amazed. Gets you, don't it? John said gleefully. You mean he left it to Kyra, I said at last. Left it in trust to Kyra. No, that's just what he did not do. I asked Whitmore 3 times, but by the 3rd I was starting to understand. There was method in his madness. Not much, but a little. You see, there's a condition. If he left the money to the minor child instead of to the mother, the condition would have no weight. It's funny when you consider that Maddie isn't long past minor status herself. Funny, I agreed, and thought of her dress sliding between my hands and her smooth, bare waist. I also thought of Bill Dean saying that men who went with girls that age always looked the same, had their tongues run out even if their mouths were shut. What string did he put on the money? That Maddie remain on the TR for 1 year following DeVore's death, until July 17, 1999. She can leave on day trips, but she has to be tucked up in her TR-90 bed every night by 9 o'clock, or else the legacy is forfeit. Did you ever hear such a bullshit thing in your life? Outside of some old George Sanders movie, that is? No, I said, and recalled my visit to the Freiburg Fair with Kyra. Even in death, he's seeking custody, I had thought, and of course, this was the same thing. He wanted them here. Even in death, he wanted them on the TR. It won't fly? I asked. Of course it won't fly. Fucking crackpot might as well have written he'd give her $80 million if she used blue tampons for a year. But she'll get the 80 mil all right. My heart is set on it. I've already talked to 3 of our estate guys, and you don't think I should bring one of them up with me on Tuesday, do you? Will Stevenson will be the point man in the estate phase if Maddie agrees. He was all but babbling. He hadn't had a thing to drink. I'd have bet the farm on it. But he was sky high on all the possibilities. We'd gotten to the happily ever after part of the fairy tale as far as he was concerned. Cinderella comes home from the ball through a cash cloudburst. Of course, Will's a little bit old, John was saying, about 300 or so, which means he's not exactly a fun guy at a party, but... Leave him home, why don't you? I said. There'll be plenty of time to carve up DeVore's will later on. And in the immediate future, I don't think Maddie's going to have any problem observing the bullshit condition. She just got her job back, remember? Yeah, the white buffalo drops dead and the whole herd scatters, John exulted. Look at him go, and the new multimillionaire goes back to filing books and mailing out overdue notices. Okay, Tuesday, we'll just party. Good. Party till we puke. Well, maybe us older folks will just party until we're mildly nauseated. Would that be all right? Sure. I've already called Romeo Bissonette, and he's going to bring George Kennedy, the private detective who got all that hilarious shit on Durgan. Bissonette says Kennedy's a scream when he gets a drink or two in him. I thought I'd bring some steaks from Peter Luger's. Did I tell you that? I don't believe you did. Best steaks in the world, Michael. Do you realize what's happened to that young woman? $80 million! She'll be able to replace Scouty. Huh? Nothing. Will you come in tomorrow night or on Tuesday? Tuesday morning, around 10, into Castle County Airport, New England Air. Mike, are you all right? You sound odd. I'm all right. I'm where I'm supposed to be, I think. And what's that supposed to mean? I had wandered out onto the deck. In the distance, thunder rumbled. It was hotter than hell, not a breath of breeze stirring. The sunset was fading to a baleful afterglow. The sky in the west looked like the white of a bloodshot eye. I don't know, I said, but I have an idea the situation will clarify itself. I'll meet you at the airport.
Okay, he said, and then, in a hushed, almost reverential voice, 80 million motherfucking American dollars.
It's a whole lot of lettuce, I agreed, and wished him a good night.
I drank black coffee and ate toast in the kitchen the next morning, watching the TV weatherman. Like so many of them these days, he had a slightly mad look, as if all those Doppler radar images had driven him to the brink of something. I think of it as the millennial video game look.
We've got another 36 hours of this soup to work through, and then there's going to be a big change, he was saying, and pointed to some dark gray scum lurking in the Midwest. Tiny animated lightning bolts danced in it like defective spark plugs. Beyond the scum and the lightning bolts, America looked clear all the way out to the desert country, and the posted temperatures were 15 degrees cooler.
We'll see temps in the mid-90s today and can't look for much relief tonight or tomorrow morning, but tomorrow afternoon, these frontal storms will reach western Maine, and I think most of you are going to want to keep updated on weather conditions. Before we get back to cooler air and bright, clear skies on Wednesday, we're probably going to see violent thunderstorms, heavy rain, hail in some locations. Tornadoes are rare in Maine, but some towns in western and central Maine could see them tomorrow. Back to you, Earl.
Earl, the morning news guy, had the innocent, beefy look of a recent retiree from the Chippendales and read off the teleprompter like one.
Wow, he said. That's quite a forecast, Vince. Tornado's a possibility.
Wow, I said. Say wow again, Earl. Do it till I'm satisfied.
Holy cow, Earl said, just to spite me, and the telephone rang. I went to answer it, giving the waggy clock a look as I went by. The night had been quiet, no sobbing, no screaming, no nocturnal adventures, but the clock was disquieting just the same. It hung there on the wall, eyeless and dead, like a message full of bad news.
Hello? Mr. Noonan?
I knew the voice, but for a moment couldn't place it. It was because she had called me Mr. Noonan. To Brenda Meserve, I'd been Mike for almost 15 years.
Mrs. M? Brenda?
What?
I can't work for you anymore, she said, all in a rush. I'm sorry I can't give you proper notice. I never stopped work for anyone without giving notice, not even that old drunk Mr. Croydon, but I have to. Please understand.
Did Bill find out I called you? I swear to God, Brenda, I never said a word.
No, I haven't spoken to him, nor he to me. I just can't come back to Sarah Laughs. I had a bad dream last night. A terrible dream. I dreamed that something's mad at me. If I come back, I could have an accident. It would look like an accident, at least, but 'twouldn't be.
That's silly, Mrs. M., I wanted to say. You're surely past the age where you believe in campfire stories about ghoulies and ghosties and long-leggedy beasties. But, of course, I could say no such thing. What was going on in my house was no campfire story. I knew it, and she knew I did.
Brenda, if I've caused you any trouble, I'm truly sorry.
Go away, Mr. Noonan. Mike, go back to Derry and stay for a while. It's the best thing you could do.
I heard the letters sliding on the fridge and turned. This time I actually saw the circle of fruits and vegetables form. It stayed open at the top long enough for 4 letters to slide inside. Then a little plastic lemon plugged the hole and completed the circle.
Yats, the letters said, then swapped themselves around, making stay. Then both the circle and the letters broke up.
Mike, please, Mrs. M. was crying. Royce's funeral is tomorrow. Everyone on the TR who matters, the old-timers, will be there.
Yes, of course they would. The old ones, the bags of bones, who knew what they knew and kept it to themselves. Except some of them had talked to my wife. Royce himself had talked to her. Now he was dead. So was she.
"'Twould be best if you were gone. You could take that young woman with you, maybe. Her and her little girl.
But could I? I somehow didn't think so.
I thought the three of us were on the TR until this was over, and I was starting to have an idea of when that would be. A storm was coming, a summer storm, maybe even a tornado. "Brenda, thanks for calling me, and I'm not letting you go. Let's just call it a leave of absence, shall we?" "Fine, whatever you want. Will you at least think about what I said?" "Yes. In the meantime, I don't think I'd tell anyone you called me, all right?"
"No,"
she said, sounding shocked. Then,
"But they'll know. Bill and Yvette, Dickie Brooks at the garage, old Anthony Wayland and Buddy Jellison and all the others. They'll know. Goodbye, Mr. Noonan. I'm so sorry. For you and your wife. Your poor wife. I'm so sorry."
And then she was gone. I held the phone in my hand for a long time. Then, like a man in a dream, I put it down, crossed the room, and took the eyeless clock off the wall. I threw it in the trash and went down to the lake for a swim, remembering that W.F. Harvey story, August Heat, the one that ends with the line, "The heat is enough to drive a man mad."